Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Old Men and the Three ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
You know, these long West Coast trips to call games have given me the gift of time. Time to put on some headphones and listen to my favorite audio titles on Audible. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. From bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries, and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. Now, I personally love a good murder mystery, and I'm currently listening to An Honest Man by Michael Corrida. It's about murders on a yacht. What more do I need to say? As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500. That's audible.com/JJ or text JJ to 500-500. It's halftime and the scoreboard is not looking good, but that's when you say to yourself, it's time to get back in the game and take as much of my friend's money as I possibly can. That's right. The hit mobile game Monopoly Go lets you compete with your friends to be the biggest tycoon ever. It's classic Monopoly, but anytime with tons of twists. Play on countless Monopoly boards, charge your friends rent, or smash their landmarks with a wrecking ball. You can even team up with friends for extra rewards. So put on your game face and download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store or Google Play. As always, The Old Man of the Three is brought to you by our friends at Cash App. Cash App is the payment app. It is the most versatile payment app there is on the market. You can invest, you can save, you can send money, you can buy crypto. Whatever you want to do, I guarantee you can do it on Cash App. Welcome to The Old Man of the Three with JJ Redick and Tommy Alter, presented by Cash App and brought to you by 342 Productions. This is episode 119, Stephen A. Smith. Tommy, this was a real treat and a fun one for us to do. Obviously, I've been on Stephen A.'s show going on 6 or 7 months now and have fun every time I go on. And it was awesome to get him on our show.
Yeah, everybody knows Stephen A. I think they know, you know, they know the Stephen A. as the performer and as the character, and it was really interesting for us to sort of unpack some of his background because he's been at this a long time, and he talks about it, but the grind explains a lot of, you know, why he is where he is right now.
For sure, and you know, I think a lot of our conversation, and he has some background in this, and we'll tell the backstory on that during the interview, but a lot of our conversation focuses on the relationship between the athletes and media, and specifically towards the end of the conversation, how that relates today with this sort of momentum towards, quote, the new media, which Draymond media. Coined, of course. I'm not stealing Draymond's line. And sort of we unpack a little bit how that relationship is going to go work going forward. And of course, we talk about First Take. We spend the first 20 minutes of this conversation talking about First Take and the background of that show, my appearances on that show, Stephen A. and I's relationship on that show and off the show. But just so we're clear, because literally yesterday we recorded this, CJ McCollum and I called Stephen A. out for some bullshit. That went viral. Today, Stephen and I got into it on Get Up with Mike Greenberg.
Yeah,
that went viral. None of, you know, these disagreements that happen with us on camera, none of this affects our personal relationship at all. And he's someone that I've known since I was an NBA player, and obviously now know quite well, both from being on set with him and our conversations off set. So I hope you guys really enjoy this.
It is funny. It's funny how people think every time you guys, and we talk about this with him a little bit, every time you have a disagreement, it means that like you hate each other. You're like, yeah. You're there every week. I mean, it just is, you wouldn't come back. Like life's too, if you, like I think our listeners and our viewers should know this about you at this point. If you hate somebody, you're not going to keep going back and sitting across from them. Like you have a lot of money. Like this is not, it's not realistic. It's not a thing that is actually going to happen. So I don't know. It's one of the reasons why I'm glad that we had him on is to kind of like dispel that.
I totally agree. And I've talked about this for a number of times because we tend to focus on our guests
obviously with the interviews, but there has been times within the intro where certain things that have happened on First Take have come up and we address. And, you know, I have enjoyed that show so much, and I've enjoyed working for him. And I'll say it again, which I've said three or four times already on this podcast, is that I have a deep appreciation for how he has built his career. I have a deep appreciation for how hard he works, and I have a deep appreciation for his talent. That's not to say that he has some god fucking awful takes.
And he needs somebody to shove them back in his face sometimes, which we talk about. It is, and I'm not going to step on the conversation right now, but it's boring if everyone is agreeing with each other, and it's boring if somebody comes and is low energy. And he's completely right about this, and this isn't unique just to sports television. Nobody wants to turn on TV and watch somebody with like a mild-mannered, like boring take, monotone take on something.
Speaking in cliches.
It's just ham it up, and he's one of the best.
It's the media world we live in. One note we should mention. So we are recording this on Wednesday, about three hours before game three. So there are no notes on game three. That is because I will be taking my kids just got out of school. I will be taking them on a short little vacation to celebrate the end of the school year. We will be back next week on Monday with a YouTube live breaking down games three and four. So please go to subscribe to our YouTube channel. And the other note I wanted to mention is we have already recorded next week's episode.
Yes.
And that is with a Hall of Famer. And
very good episode. We will not spoil it right now, but very good.
Yes, very good episode. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. So we've got a lot of fun stuff coming up for you guys. And as always, we appreciate you listening. Go hit subscribe, and let's get to our conversation with ESPN personality, ESPN analyst, ESPN...
Jack of all trades.
Jack of all trades, the hardest working man in show business, Stephen A. Smith.
All right, let's welcome in Stephen A.
What's up, man? How you doing, man?
I'm good. This is a real treat because for the last 6 or 7 months... Yeah. I've been going on your show,
yeah,
and now it's time for you to come on my show.
You haven't done bad. You haven't done bad, JJ. You've done pretty good for yourself.
What was your first TV impression of JJ?
It's interesting because JJ automatically puts you on your heels. I've long admired JJ Redick as a player from his days at Duke, but especially when he came into the NBA because he was no nonsense. And if you were a reporter and you walked up to him and you asked him a question, he would be respectful and professional. But you also know just by a look in his eye, if he looked at you like, do you have any idea what you're talking about? You know, he was one of those guys. And so, you know, I always respect the fact that whether it's with his body language or his actual words, he always came across as a straight shooter. And I always respect that with guys.
We all read Twitter comments after our segments. Yeah. We try to get feedback. It's an interesting way to get feedback.
Right.
And I remember early on a first few hits I did on your show, there would be a comment like, Stephen A is not going to let JJ back on the show. Was I ever in danger of not being invited back?
That was never true. It's amazing what people don't get about First Take. It's a 2-hour debate show. And obviously I'm the face of the franchise now. And, you know, they come to me and the bosses come to me and they put a lot of responsibility on my shoulders. And so for me, all I care about is that you're honest and true and authentic with your perspectives. Obviously, being respectful of everybody that's on it. That's all I care about. You know, and to me, what folks don't realize, I want people to disagree with me. People keep forgetting I've been a journalist for 28 years. I've been covering the NBA for a quarter century. I'm an antagonist. And it's by nature. It's not like I'm not doing it for ratings. I've always been this way. When I go and I talk to a player, or I talk to a team, I talk to a coach, I talk to a general manager, an owner, a president of basketball operations, I'm literally looking at them. Okay, what's your definition of success? Tell me what your expectations are, whether it's about the team, it's an individual. Tell me why, whatever. And then I'm in your face all year long reminding you of what you said, because that's the standard that I'm holding you. I'm not looking at you and I'm jumping to this conclusion. I'm letting you tell the story. And I think that I have a very unique approach compared to most journalist. I played basketball, certainly not on these guys' level, but I played for Clarence Big House Games, who was a legend. His mentor was John McClendon, who helped integrate the sport of basketball. These are the guys that tutored me. And then my first job in the business, I was covering John Chaney. And then after that, I covered Larry Brown. So I've been surrounded by the game or involved with the game of basketball pretty much my entire life. And they taught me how to look at the game from the standpoint of understanding what you don't know. I don't go to a player challenging their knowledge. I go to players challenging their willingness to be honest about their knowledge. I don't go to a J.J. Redick thinking for 1 second I know more than him. What I'll say is, I'm a reporter, and I happen to know this, and there's more than what you're telling me, so give it to me. That's entirely different, which is why you'll see J.J. Redick smiling and laughing and all of this other stuff. Whereas if you got on with another pundit, you might be a bit offended because they're trying to act like they know what you know. And I never do that. I am a guy who chronicles what I see and what you say and what you show us. I never think for 1 second that I know what actual participants know.
We're going to get into your background, and I want to talk about your playing career as well, and the early grind, because I think it is fascinating. I think it portrays you with a sense of credibility that maybe some of your critics don't give you enough credit for. And I want to get into that, but I want to stay on First Take for a second because. You know, we both read this article in the New Yorker just about the changing landscape of how media works across the board, and it's not so much about telling you the news. When I was a kid, I would watch SportsCenter, would come on the first episode at 6 a.m., then they'd rerun it through basically noon, and then strongman competition would come off. And now we're very much a 24/7 discussion debate show. The debate network, the origins of First Take, the origins of this embrace the debate notion, where did that come from? Where was that sort of driving force behind
As it pertains to First Take?
Yes.
What happened was Skip Bayless was doing First Take, and they were doing it based out of New York. It was called Cold Pizza. And they had just a regular conventional sports talk show, and they had incorporated debates for a segment here or there with Skip Bayless and Woody Page. Well, a couple years later, they moved it to Bristol, Connecticut, to the headquarters of ESPN, called it First Take, changed the name from Copies to the First Take. And then one of these days, a guy by the name of Jamie Horowitz was an executive here, and he took over First Take for a short period of time. He did a focus group. And the focus group said, we don't want all that other stuff. We want debate. And so he took First Take from a conventional show and changed it into an all debate format featuring Skip Bayless. And that's when it really took off. Of course, Pardon the Interruption was already in play, Around the Horn and stuff like that. But as it pertained to First Take, that's where its real origin came from. Skip was doing it with a potpourri of individuals for a few years. I had been gone from ESPN over a contract dispute from May of 2009 to February of 2011. Skip Bayless was doing his thing with First Take, having the two live stews, Jemele Hill, Rob Parker, and various other people debating against him. And then in 2012, they weren't satisfied with the numbers. They weren't satisfied with the ratings, the level of revenue that was being generated. Skip Bayless comes to me in the parking lot. On the campus of ESPN in Bristol, Connecticut. And he says, I know you got your plans. You love the NBA. You love being out on the road. You love being in the locker room. But I need you. He said, I've done all that I could to take this as far as I could go. I need you to do this for me, please. He said, I just need 3 years. He said, I think we'll knock it out the park. I thought about it. Those were clearly my best options. They weren't about to give me my own show or anything like that at the time. I thought about it for a couple of days. I said, all right, I'll do it. 1 month later, we were number one. And we've been number one ever since. And so when it skyrocketed to that point, it was like, oh, shit, I didn't see this coming. You know, I knew we'd be successful, but I didn't know we'd skyrocket to the number one morning show. And it happened a month after I arrived, and it's never changed.
We talk about the chemistry all the time with things like this. Did you feel that chemistry right away?
Yeah, we always had the chemistry. Skip and I used to work at Fox together. Jim Rome, Rome is Burning.
Yeah.
He had that show on ESPN. It was called The Last Word when he was on Fox. And we would be in Fox Studios off of Pico Boulevard and Avenue of the Stars, which I absolutely loved. The palm trees, the sunshine, lunch outside with 90-degree weather, sunshine beaming down. And y'all just loved it, you know. And they did a pilot with Skip and I because Skip and I used to debate all the time and we never agreed on anything. But I love the fact that, again, he stood for what he felt. And his whole thing is, this is what I believe and I can make that argument. Now, no matter how much I disagreed, I respected the fact that that's how he felt. And that was an argument that he could make. So we would debate sometimes in the hallways. And then the executives saw us one time. They watched him do his work. They watched me do my work when I was on the Best Damn Sports Show, period. And they said, let's create a pilot. And we created a pilot. It was called Sports in Black and White. And they were basically trying to create it to go up against PTI. And we did it. They loved it. We were in contract talks the whole bit. And at the 11th hour and 59th minute, the head of Fox, David Hill, pulled the plug and said, this is not what we want to do. And so from that moment on, that was in the year 2000. From that moment on, Skip and I had always wondered what it would be like if we had worked together, because we had kept in touch throughout the years. So when the opportunity finally came and he approached me in that parking lot, that was what he brought up. This is unfinished business. We were supposed to do this 12 years ago, but here we are again, and this is our opportunity. Stephen A., I need you to do this for me. And by this time, I was coming on once a week because I had returned in 2011, and then a few months in, I would come on every Wednesday, and the ratings would blow up, and he said, I need you to do it.
Did your relationship with Skip ever fracture? Was there any of your contentiousness there?
Never. The only time anything came close to that was when I knew he was leaving before he told me. And I was like, what the hell's going on? You know? And so I confronted him because for better or worse, I'm a straight up guy. You know, if I work with you and all of a sudden I'm leaving, you ain't going to find out from somebody else. You're going to hear it from me. I'm going to come looking for you to tell you. I'm going to give you the news face to face. And I was hearing it and I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then when he confessed to me what had transpired between his negotiations with the company, I understood why he couldn't tell me in the immediate moment. But that's literally the only thing that we've ever had any kind of issue about. And that lasted for like 6 hours.
So with anyone that has come on the show, myself included, there's that critique of the critique towards the disagreement, right? Mm-hmm. The critique towards the contentiousness which plays itself out on a debate show. And so the critique often is, well, it's just a bunch of people yelling at each other, but isn't inherently a show centered around debate, especially when we talk about things, because, you know, give everyone a little secret to the thing. Like, we only pick topics generally that we are going to disagree on.
That's right.
We only pick topics generally that we are particularly passionate,
exactly,
that we want to talk about. And so a lot of times it ends up, I'm probably guilty of this as anyone, is like the body language, the emotion, like it's just inherently part of what we're doing. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on sort of that critique of the show.
Well, to me, it is a debate show. And for the most part, you shouldn't have the same perspective and the same point of view as your counterpart. Otherwise, it's not embracing debate because it's not a debate. So it's about giving the audience what they expect. It doesn't mean that things can't be tweaked. It doesn't mean that you can't be agreeable from time to time. It doesn't mean that you can't reach a conclusion that's similar to one another once you have that discussion. But it's a discussion. And again, we could talk about yelling, we could talk about fiery, whatever, but it's about projection. Everybody can't get away with mumbling and being successful on TV like Shaquille O'Neal. They can't do that. Okay, most people, if you're mumbling on TV, nobody wants to watch you. You see what I'm saying? If you're not passionate about what you're discussing and you're not aggressive to some degree, maybe that's not the appropriate word, but just assertive with it to some degree about your position, then why should anybody feel passionate about what you have to say?
So this brings me to something that I wanted to ask you about and bring up, and that's just the Stephen A on camera versus the Stephen A off camera.
Right.
Because,
right.
I tell people, what's Stephen A like? People ask me that all the time. What's Stephen A like? I'm like, well, there's the person I know on camera and there's the person I know off camera.
Right.
How are you so able to seamlessly change that? Because you aren't this loud, demonstrative person off camera. You're actually, I would describe you as soft-spoken off camera. I mean, believe it or not, I would describe you as that.
I wouldn't describe myself as that, Jay. But I will say this to you. The lights come on. It's time to perform. And that doesn't mean faking who you are. That means bringing out that element that's appropriate for that platform that you're working in. Again, I can't get away with my, if I think about this, and I've often said this to folks that have asked me this question. So J.J. Redick himself, let's ask J.J. that question rhetorically anyway. If I came on First Take and sat across from you and I said to you, well, JJ, I disagree with you. You know, here's the reason why. You'd be like, holy shit, what the hell's wrong with him? Something's not right. But more importantly, the part that you may not see because you're not that experienced at doing this show is that what kind of position would that put you in? See, as the face of the show that they've handed this to, it's not just my responsibility to go on the air and spout my opinion. It's my responsibility to provide a show. So a lot of times, again, I'm not faking what I feel. I'm not inauthentic or anything like that. But what I am doing is looking at J.J. Redick, and I'm like, I know I'm going to get him with this. You know, I know this is going to get him riled up. And I'm messing with him, and I'm tugging at you because we're doing a show. And there's an audience out there that we're projecting to, and we have a responsibility to feed them, at least to some degree, what they came. If you come to a steak restaurant, man, you ain't looking for shrimp. You looking for steak. You see what I'm saying? You come to a seafood spot, you ain't looking for a burger. You know, I mean, you got to give the audience to some degree what they get, but in the same breath, do it in an authentic fashion where they know you're not faking it, you're not cheating them, you're not selling them a bag of goods that's not authentic and what have you. And so to me, that's my responsibility when it comes to First Take. It's not just me. I got to make sure I feed Molly. I'm feeding JJ. It's CJ. It's Swagoo. It's anybody. If you notice, I'm messing with everybody because you're not going to lay down and go to sleep with me across from you. You never know what I'm going to come at you with. I do it on purpose.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I wanted to get to. So I'm not saying that your character is inauthentic, but you are saying you're playing a character in some ways.
Well, I don't, it's a part of my personality.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I go home, JJ, I'm off the air. And literally, my sisters will tell you, it'll be a family gathering. And I'll walk through the door and I say, I have arrived. And everybody's like, whatever. And then we had a family picnic or whatever. I said, damn it, I'm sorry, y'all. They're like, what? I said, it's time for me to go. You know? So I'm messing with people all the time because it is a part of my personality is what I'm saying. It's not something that I don't do. I remember years ago, man, I bring this up because Mo Cheeks was the assistant coach of the Philadelphia 76ers. He got me back good. Because I go to a Sixers game, Palace in Auburn Hills, and I'm coming back with about three other sports writers in the car with me. They pulled me over, said that, you know, ultimately told me I was driving with a suspended license, cuffed me, you know, threw me in the jail cell in Troy, Michigan. This is like in 1999. I was pissed. Oh, I was hot. And I'm going off and stuff like that. And I come back the next day, and I'm going to the Philadelphia 76ers practice, and I'm complaining about this. And Mo Cheeks said, all I want to know is it in the papers? Is it in the papers? Because that was his way of getting back at me, saying, you would have put it in the paper if it was us. You know, so it's guys who know me know that I have a personality and, you know, you can vibe with me. We can talk. We might disagree or whatever. But if I'm your guy, I'm your guy. And I'm going to have your back. And we're going to have a good time. We're going to even have a good time going at each other. And we can agree to disagree. I'm not going to be offended by somebody disagreeing with me. I'm not going to be offended by JJ saying, you have lost your mind. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. I'm like, what? And then the minute we go to commercial, good job. You know, that was good. You know what I'm saying? And we have a good time. And you know, we go from there.
If you've been following the pod, you know I'm stepping my suit game up as I'm calling more and more games. So shout out Indochino for getting me all prepared for this home stretch of games.
It's also wedding season, so you can get in on looking great. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into the wedding season looking like $1 million, even though the suits start at just $499. You can either book an appointment at one of their showrooms or do what I did and set up your measurement profile on Indochino's website and choose customizations without even leaving the house. I just ordered a nice plum suit with pinstripes. I'm trying to tap into my inner Walt Frazier, and I think it's working. The entire process was super simple, and the suit fits great. That's the sweet spot. So look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code OLDMAN to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code OLDMAN. If you're like me and appreciate great quality, easy-to-wear clothes in your closet, let me introduce you to Rails. They're a Los Angeles-based brand that blends their California roots with an elevated European aesthetic, and the fabrics feel as good as they look. From super luxe button-downs and essential outerwear to vacation-ready shorts and tees, Rails is consciously crafted for the modern man on the move. With the sun coming out, I recently got myself a few short-sleeve button-downs, and they are super light and comfortable. Try Rails for yourself at their flagship stores in New York, San Francisco, Boston, London, Paris, and beyond, or at Rails.com. And take 15% off your order with the code JJ. That's 15% off with code JJ at Rails.com.
You mentioned that you played college basketball.
I tried to play. That's what I said. I tried to play, JJ. I didn't play. I tried to play, but go ahead.
For Clarence Big House Gaines,
yep.
A legendary coach.
Yep.
And we were with Grant Hill yesterday, whose episode will be out next week.
Yep.
And he told us this story about you writing a very critical critical article in the student newspaper while you were playing for Clarence Gaines.
That is
and
true.
I was like, that can't be true. There's
it,
more to this
it
story.
Is true. It
and
is
then
true.
We did our research, yes. And it is
yeah,
true.
It is true. But it was more to the story than that. Coach Gaines was like a father to me, and he had health issues. And I don't know whether it was cerebral palsy or whatever it was, but he would literally at times have to wear a patch over his eye. He was catching mild strokes and stuff like that. And he was a guy that, you know, I never had a great relationship with my dad. And when I got there, you know, he gravitated towards me, and we'd sit back practically 4 or 5 days a week in his office and giving me just life lessons and talking to me about a lot of things. He said, because damn it, you ain't going to be a pro player. Let's get that out the way right now. Damn it, you can't play that good and blah, blah, blah. And he got to a point where his health was so shaky, we'd see it literally while he was on the sidelines. There were a couple of times we thought he was going to fall over and collapse. And so I went into his office one day and I said, it's time. You know, you got to go. You got to go home, be with you. You got a wife, you got children, you got grandchildren. You got to go home, man. And he said, shut the fuck up. That's exactly what he said to me. And I said, I'm serious, coach, you know. And I said, you know, I'm studying journalism in a whole bit. I'm call it like I see it. Be fair. Be as accurate as I possibly can, but be upfront and stuff like that. And he would talk to me about my career aspirations. And I said, I'm going to write this. He said, fuck you, man. I said, okay. And then I wrote the article, you know. And so when I wrote the article without giving all the medical details about his business, you had the chancellor and a bunch of other people that were just appalled, like, you know, the legends in the broadcasting and beyond, Coach K and others. I don't know what they were saying, but I just heard everybody was like, who the hell is this no-name kid, blah, blah, blah. And the chancellor wanted me expelled. And Coach Gaines stepped in and stopped him and literally said, he told me what he was going to do. He told me why. He told me to my face before he did it. And I told him to go ahead. Leave him alone. And I always remember that, because years later when people would get on me and they'd see me on TV and Coach Gaines would be like, damn it, everybody don't want all the truth all the damn time. Won't want you telling them about themselves. I said, that's what you told me to do. He said, well, goddammit, I changed my mind. you know? And I said, not so easy, coach. I said, but I never tell everything, coach. And you know, I don't get into people's personal business. But I said, I got to call it like I see it. Everybody watching, I got to call it like I see it. He said, okay. When somebody cuss your ass out, don't say anything. I said, did I say something when you cussed me out? He said, that's true. And that was pretty much it.
What's interesting to me about this story, of particular interest to me is, because the whole story is very interesting. What's of particular interest to me is that you essentially were a pioneer. You were at the forefront of athlete-driven media content when you think about it.
Yeah, you know, listen, like I said, I tried to play. But I mean, listen, when I was in high school, my senior year in high school, I was 5'9", 130 pounds. My first year in college, I gained like about 5 pounds. And I went to FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology, because I didn't have any scholarship offers because I only played basketball my senior year. And I played in a tournament at that school. I dropped 27 and they were like, we want you. And then I went there thinking I would go there for a couple of years and then transfer to a 4-year university. And when I went there for 1 year, Winston-Salem State came calling because a former player there was a family friend of mine. And he drove me down for a tryout. And it was the greatest shooting performance I ever had in my life because I've never done it since. And I never did it before that. But that particular day, that tryout, I went down to Winston-Salem and I just passed the ball around when Coach Gaines put me on the court, and Coach Gaines blew the whistle and he called me over because he's 6'6", 280, and he was older. He wasn't about to get up. So he blew the whistle and said, come over here. He said, ain't you supposed to be a shooter? I said, yes. He said, well, goddammit, shoot the ball. And I said, all right. And I went out there and I hit 17 straight three-pointers. I've never done that in my life before or after. But that day, I hit 17 three-pointers straight, and he signed me to a scholarship on the spot. And so, you know, from that point forward, it was like, wow, this is what happens and all of this other stuff. But I cracked my kneecap in half my first year there. A month in, I went up for a layup, and my kneecap split. And I wasn't at Duke. I wasn't at North Carolina. We didn't have the facilities and the medical coverage. So I had the operation at Wake Forest Hospital, right in Winston-Salem. And I could only rehab off of my mother's insurance, which forced me to leave school to go back and rehab. And because I wanted to get back to school so badly, I did exactly what was necessary for rehab, pretty much nothing else. And my knee was never the same. And that was what happened.
That was the end of the playing
career. That was the end. I still was on scholarship. I could still go on the basketball court and bust somebody's ass. But if you asked me to run up and down the court for 20, 25 minutes at a time, couldn't do it.
When you got to the Daily News and when you're at the Inquirer, how good of a verbal communicator were you?
Obviously, I've always been a verbal communicator. So my mother told me I could talk coming out of the womb.
So what was the – but so like was there a period where like the switch flipped and you're like, oh, I'm now, because I mean,
instead of you talking about in terms of print, from print to television,
radio, everything like that.
I did in my career what I try to encourage folks to do. Like, see, JJ is a former NBA player that's not, but he's a rookie in the media. That's what I call him, a rookie. I literally take it as a badge of honor to help him and anybody that I can excel in this business. They can call me up, talk to me. Ask me anything that they want, I'll do anything that I can to help them, because that's what people did for me. And when I was in print journalism, the real change in my career took place in 2001 when the Philadelphia 76ers went to the NBA Finals. Allen Iverson, I'm the beat writer covering the team. I'm breaking all the stories. I mean, I know everybody. I got connections all over the league. I know what's going on, blah, blah, blah. And for the purposes of Philadelphia's newspaper, I'm really killing it. But once they got to the playoffs, nothing mattered. The features department, the investigative department, other writers, the columnists, everybody it took over, because what they're trying to do is generate, you know, revenue from ad sales and what have you, because you got to maximize stuff. When a team wins, that's what the print industry, that's what they all do. And I was nothing. I had my 800 word, I had my space for my 800 word article, and that's all I could do. And I said, what the hell is this? So I look around and I'm like, we got radio hosts. They say more in 3 minutes than I can write in an entire article. and they got an hour, 2 hour, 3 hour show. Plus, I'm getting paid $75,000. They getting paid $300,000-$500,000 a year. Television, they getting paid seven figures. I'm like, what? I mean, I ain't blind. This is where the money is. And on top of it all, as good as everyone thought I could write, I knew I could talk better than I could write. So I'm like, wait a minute. I get to talk instead of write and make more money. This is not a hard transition to make. And so I can't. And from that point forward, I made up my mind that that was the direction that I was going to go in. So I was a insider for CNNSI when CNNSI existed. Fox Sports came calling. When Fox Sports came calling, then they created the best damn sports show, period. They wanted me on the show to be next to Chris Rose and Tom Arnold. I was making, again, $75,000 a year. They offered me a 3-year contract for $1.4 million, and I turned it down. The reason I turned it down was because I wanted to be taken seriously. And I know you can't be taken seriously sitting next to a comedian every day. No shade on Tom Arnold whatsoever. Great comedian, great guy, loved him the whole bit. But he's a comedian. And if you're sitting next to a comedian, you get attached to that. And you're presumably that person or like a sidekick of that person, which prevents the ESPNs of the world and others to come down the pike to hire you. I saw that ahead of time and said no, because my sights was on getting here. And 3 years later, I got here. Now, I still was a contributor to the show in terms of giving the NBA insider interviews and stuff like that. But John Sally ultimately took that role. He took that role because I turned it down.
Did you enjoy being a beat writer? Pay aside.
I loved it.
You loved it.
I loved it. Because I've always been a guy who believed. The reason why I never backed down is because, number one, I was on the scene. Number two, I knew I was willing to talk to the people that I talked about. I wasn't running from anybody. And number three, I knew I was fair. I always knew that I was the kind of person, if you showed me I was wrong and I did something publicly that was erroneous or whatever, I wasn't going to apologize privately. I wasn't going to correct it privately. I would go right back on the same platform that I screwed up on. And I would say, nope, he's right. I was wrong. I knew I've always been that person. So the fact that I knew that about myself, that put me in a very potent position, because players respect that. JJ knows this. Players respect that. You know, you want to fess up. First of all, we respect when we see you. You got something to say, and then you in the locker room, they respect that. Number two, if you're willing to correct yourself, they respect that too. And number three, I was on the scene, because I had to travel wherever the team went. So I was courtside. I was in the locker room. I was there covering the team on off days. I didn't just get the first take. I spent, you know, 20 damn years in this business before first take ever came along, pounding that pavement, going to games, covering practices, traveling with the team, doing all of that stuff on an everyday basis.
What I think is remarkable, though, and we've talked about this a little bit off camera, but what I think is remarkable is that, you know, you started, I think, at Winston-Salem Journal, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Winston-Salem Journal for free.
In school.
Yeah, yes. While you were in school. You wrote for your student newspaper.
Yep.
You were a beat writer. You grinded through a bunch of television shows.
Yep.
Now you're in a position, let's be honest, you're I believe, the highest paid talent at ESPN. Until those guys signed their deal for Monday Night Football. And my observation of you, having worked with you for the last 6 or 7 months, is that grind hasn't stopped. Mm-hmm. And that's what I find to be pretty remarkable. I mean, we do the show. Mm-hmm. If you could fly in for just one day, you're flying in to do the show in person. You've got Countdown. You've got Stephen A's World. You go on almost every other show at some point in time, whether that's, you know, Get Up or a radio show.
Yeah.
You're always out there grinding. And I'm curious if the grind is the enjoyment. The work is a little bit that feeling of relevancy and cherishing that feeling. Is that a little bit of it?
I guess so. But I think the biggest thing is, let's just be honest, it's the power, it's the influence. And what I mean by that is that one of the reasons I can jump all over an athlete is because I'll challenge anybody to find somebody who defends athletes more than me, other than the athletes themselves. And I'm talking about a career where it's not just what I do on camera, on the microphone, on radio, or in a newsroom for a television network, or a television network, or a print newspaper. What I've done behind the scenes to fight to make sure athletes got a fair shake, I'll put my record up against anybody. Because there's a lot of stuff that athletes don't know. Like, I'm big on, let's be fair, I'm big on, that's their personal life. What the hell are you doing that for? They're not in police blotters. You don't know what the hell is going on. Why would you say something like that? People don't realize how many stories I've stopped from getting printed, stopped from getting publicized or whatever, just because it was grossly unfair and it was very presumptuous and we had no business as an industry doing those kind of things. So when you know you're fighting those battles, you know there's a level of influence that comes along with it. So when somebody tries to come along and be like, what the hell are you just doing? You just running your mouth. I laugh because the instant thought that comes to my mind is you clearly don't know my background. You don't know my history. You don't know the sacrifices that I've made and how much money I would be making even now if I was willing to sell you out. But I've never been that guy. And so for me, it's just when you talk about power and influence, what I mean by that is that I say something that resonates. Last year, 1.5 billion people watched me on YouTube. 1.5 billion. I make sure I have these numbers. I know exactly what kind of impact that I have. And I know that that's the impact that a beat writer is going to the games and all of this other stuff. Well, owners called me, president of basketball operations called me, players called me, et cetera, which is why a lot of times if a player challenges or they've got something to say and they'll pick up the phone and call me, and I'm like, you think you're the only one? You think, are you accusing me of getting this out of thin air? You think somebody didn't tell me this? Oh, no, we know somebody told you this. Okay, well, let's understand that then. So if I'm wrong, you got enemies. What you gonna do about that? You know, and so all of a sudden you see how things swirl and how news percolates and how change actually takes place behind the scenes, 90% of which people never see. I'm the person, I'm one of the people that has an abundance of people on speed dial, and they have me on speed dial and they will text or pick up the phone. That's why a lot of times there has not been one segment, and JJ probably knows this, maybe doesn't. There has not been one single segment I've been on the air with you where I'm not getting text messages from people in the league while we're talking. Get him. He's wrong. No, Steven, he got you there. He's right about that. I mean, they're literally giving commentary on our commentary.
We had an incident 3-4 weeks ago. Yeah. I'm not going to name the person, sure. But where the guy literally texted both of us simultaneously.
That's right. Exactly.
The same.
About why we were both wrong,
that's right.
Actually.
That's right. But what I'm saying is, that for me, that's every show, every segment of every show.
Yeah.
Which is why when people sit up there and say, he doesn't know, they don't get it. I'm not one of those commentators that think I know more than the people involved. I think I know something because the people involved told me. Yeah. There's a difference. So if I'm sitting here with you and JJ, and JJ walks out today and JJ, there's some news going on about JJ. Somebody might come up to me and ask me, do you know? Yeah, I know. Well, what is it then? None of your damn business. And they'll go like this. Well, you must not know because you're not saying anything. I know I just spoke to JJ. I'm just not telling you. Yeah. So that's where my power comes from, because I know that people communicate with me all the time and they use me as a conduit for whatever information they want disseminated. That's my job as a journalist.
We were talking about the performance angle earlier, about mm-hmm. turning it on. Do you think if you, from your own personal interest level, if you decided to be in like another field, whether it be politics, entertainment, this wouldn't necessarily work for television.
He is a star actor.
You covered crime.
Right.
You covered crime when you're reporting and stuff. Yeah. So like, could this translate to anything if you had decided like 5 years ago, like, oh, I want to really do politics. I really want to do entertainment. I really want to do whatever.
When ESPN let me go in 2009, I appeared on Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN 150 times. I honestly thought that could be a possibility. In 2015, one of those networks, CNN, actually interviewed me for my own show on CNN. I can honestly tell you, I believe that if I were in politics, it might have got me killed because of the world we're living in. Because if it didn't get me killed, it would have me as a pariah by half of the country. Like the likes of a Sean Hannity or whatever. Because when I'm doing stuff and I'm in, I don't view myself as a second place kind of guy. I'm coming to be the top dog. That's just by nature. And I'm not going to fake the funk or whatever. I just know that when I do things, I know how to resonate with an audience. And if I were doing politics, we talk about real life issues, things that affect the average everyday American. And the thing that would be so dangerous about me is I'm not one-sided. Sometimes the liberals are right. Sometimes the conservatives are right. It's on a case-by-case basis. But the one thing I could assure you of is I would piss off millions. Literally, subject by subject. Because I'm taking a side, and I'm not scared to do that. I'm scared to take an ideological position. Because I don't believe in that. I believe that it's a case-by-case basis. I think it's very impractical.
Living in the gray.
That's right.
Living in the gray.
I'm not that guy. Yeah. I'm a guy. The incident tells how I feel about gay rights is entirely different by how I might feel about the economy. I'm a liberal when it comes to gay rights. I am a fiscal conservative when it comes to my money. I can't stand paying taxes. It drives me nuts. I'm thinking, I can't wait to get out of New York City. I'm just sick of it. And I was born and raised in this town. I'm sick of taking my damn money in taxes. It just drives me nuts. Okay? The things that I do from a business perspective, the decisions that I make, the things I'm in pursuit of, primarily is because I'm tired of all my money being taken. I want to be more of an entrepreneur. I want to make sure, you know, I'm aware of what a capital gains tax is. I'm aware of what income tax is. I know the states that don't have income taxes, okay, that don't pay state income taxes. I know these states. I can give it to you chapter and verse. I pay attention to this stuff. It matters to me. And so I would take a position, and I'm unafraid to do it. And considering that it affects the lives of people, I would tell you, I'm glad I didn't, but I came very, very, very close to being a pundit. And one time I was approached by Governor Ed Rendell in Pennsylvania. He wanted me to run for Senate. Yeah, he said, you should do it. I said, you don't know, I'm not a liberal. You know, I'm not a conservative either, but I'm not. He said, don't matter with you. Don't matter with you. You're a voice that needs to be heard. He told me this about close to 10 years ago.
But doesn't it seem, not to get too sidetracked with politics, but doesn't it seem now that like showmanship and performance, I mean, obviously we saw this with our last president, it's incredibly important for all of these fields. It's like the television to politics pipeline is happening
it's over
pivotal. And over again.
It's pivotal. There's no doubt about that. But the difference between politics and everything else, even if they love you or hate you, they want more in anything other than politics. When it comes to politics, as charismatic as you may be, it does ultimately come down to what you do once you have the charisma. You can have the charisma, but you can be a person that is making decisions that's to the detriment of a segment of our society, if not our society as a whole, and all of a sudden all hell breaks loose, you know, and you got to take that into consideration. I mean, listen, you could say what you want about Donald Trump. He had charisma. There's no doubt about that. The thing that conservatives have a hard time coming at me about is when I come at him, it was never because of his politics. Because I see the world, we have to, the prism of history tells us the effectiveness of a president or lack thereof. You can't tell us in the moment. History tells us that. But what you can tell about a president is whether you're a divisive force or are you capable of galvanizing people, things of that nature. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Do y'all realize that if Donald Trump had simply said, wear a mask, and conducted himself with any kind of decorum, he'd still be president? Literally. I've said, and I'm telling you, I'm sharing this with you guys. I've said that to Sean Hannity. I've said that to Mark Levin. I mean, I know these people. You know, I've been on all of these shows, and they're sports fans. That's how I know them. But think about that. And I remember one time I said, how does it feel if the presidency is so important and it matters so much? And you have that power to influence hundreds of millions of lives, okay? and you passed on it just because you wanted to show little class and you wanted to tell, you didn't want to agree with the liberals and you politicized COVID-19. Do you realize have you not done that, you would still be president? I said, so what does it say to you about a person that knew that and still let his ego get in the way anyway? That's not politics. That's human beings. That's human communication. It transcends that. And those are the kind of things I look at.
Did not expect to have that conversation.
all right, I'm full of surprises.
You know, we'll get good. We're gonna get back on track. I do want to the part about the earlier comment you made about not really like being in a player's personal business. You know, fighting to have stories not
right.
become public. And I am curious, not just on First Take, but in anything you've written, anything you've done, are there is there particular stories or a particular take that you've had about a player that you've then regretted later on?
I regretted the beef that me and Glenn Big Dog Robinson had. As I reflect on it, I had to take the brunt of the blame for that. I'm the professional, and the professional, but even though he was a grown man, he's a professional.
What was sort of the context of that?
We had a beef because Randy Ayers got fired.
Okay.
From the Philadelphia 76ers. And I had a real problem with it because I happened to have known that at the time that he was dismissed, and you know, I'm not bringing it up to throw any shade on anybody because we dropped that a long time ago. But the issue that I had is I felt like there was disrespect accorded to him, and that led to Billy King and the 76ers believing he wasn't the guy because he didn't have the respect of the players. And I had a problem with that because he was an African-American man, and the level of disrespect that I felt was accorded to him was not right. And I said that, and because of that, Glenn and I had a beef for years. And then one day I saw his son. And his son came over to me and talked to me and was just such a gentleman and the whole bit. And I was like, damn, no, Glenn's a good father. There's no way his son would come up and talk with me if this man was behind the scenes doing all of this nonsense or anything like that. And more importantly, I didn't want his son to ever think that because of any disagreement I had with his father, that would reflect on him in any way in terms of my coverage if it came to that. And so from that moment forward, I just said, drop it. Own what your part in all of this disagreement is. Let it go. Glenn's a good guy. Y'all just got a disagreement, and that's okay. And the other one was Allen Iverson. It's hard to admit this as, you know, as an objective observer, a journalist, commentator, now all of this other stuff. But I love Allen Iverson. He's like a little brother to me. And covering him, being an African-American from the streets of New York, knowing his story and knowing what he endured, we went through a lot together covering him. I don't believe I'm sitting here in this position today if it were not for Allen Iverson. Covering him was a separate beat in and of itself. When he was a star in this league, the only person more popular than him, one could easily argue, was Michael Jordan. That's how popular Allen Iverson was. And he didn't always do the right things. And sometimes that stuff was hard to write. And a whole bunch of stuff I didn't say and I didn't write. But sometimes it left you no choice. And one time, the last time, his last stint with the Philadelphia 76ers, we didn't speak for 2 years because he was upset that I had written an article about him. He was away from the team, you know, supposedly his kid was sick or whatever, but then they saw him partying. And he didn't know any of this, but one of my editors said, I thought you said Allen Iverson was with his family. I said, you know, he is, that's what he told me, whatever. He turned around the computer and had video of Iverson surrounded by hundreds of people, you know. And he said, you write it or we'll take it out of your hands and we'll have our department write it. And so I had to write the story about how he wasn't with the team and et cetera, et cetera. And he was incredibly hurt. And we couldn't connect for a couple of years. And I started hearing that if y'all saw each other, it would be a problem, man. He won't put his hands on you, whatever. Well, that's the worst thing somebody could say to me. Because, I'm not scared of anybody. But more importantly, I got boys just like everybody else. So I went down to Atlanta looking for him. And I had a few of my boys with me, and I went down there looking for him and I found him. And we met up. And it wasn't any of that. He said, man, I don't care about the article. It's that it came from you. And when he said that, I felt this small.
Yeah.
Because I got it. I didn't know. He has a job as a player. I have a job as a reporter. And that was it. And by that time, I was a columnist, et cetera, et cetera. And I looked at it to that. And I never thought, I'm here thinking he had a problem with the story. He had no problem with the story. He said, I deal with that every day. It's the fact that your name was on the byline. And I really didn't say much.
Yeah.
But when I saw the hurt in his eyes, the story wasn't worth it to me.
OM3 fans, I need to tell you about the most comfortable pants out there. They're from Vuori, and they're magnificent. I'm not kidding. Jason told me about them. He called them butter on your legs. Vuori provides a new perspective on performance apparel, perfect if you are sick and tired of traditional old workout gear. Everything is designed to work out in, but doesn't look or feel like it. So comfortable, you will want to wear it all the time, and I do. Honestly, it's comfier than whatever you're wearing right now. Now, the pants I mentioned up top is called the Men's Sunday Performance Jogger. Grab yourself a pair. It'll change your life. Vuori is an investment in your happiness. For our listeners, they are offering 20% off your first purchase. Get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at Vuori.com/JJ. That's Vuori.com/JJ. Not only will you receive 20% off your first purchase, but enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 and free returns. Go to Vuori.com/JJ and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So I think this is one of the challenges with being in media, being a journalist, even to some degree, in my case, being a former ex-player whose friends and former teammates and peers that I respect are still playing, and you build relationships, yeah. And it's, I think, challenging to be fair and balanced, mm-hmm. and impartial and unbiased towards people,
right.
that you respect or that you have a relationship with. And that's, to me, that's a perfect example of that. And that's really one of the main challenges to your point about having these relationships with different people across, yeah. the league. That really is the biggest challenge to me.
But it's never a challenge for me to talk about your game. Like, I walk up to you in a heartbeat. You play like garbage, you don't want to see me on TV the next day. Because I'm, yeah. going to say so. But that was his personal life. That was the challenge.
Okay, but not just personal life then. Because, yes, CP had a game 7, I came on and I said, he sucked.
Exactly.
CP sucked for 5 straight games.
Exactly.
I love CP.
And I
don't
applauded
think
you for that.
Yeah.
Because that's what you have to do when it comes to their game, because everyone's watching that.
But hold on. Then it becomes about another conversation about somebody's legacy.
Right.
Another conversation about somebody's money.
Right.
How much they deserve. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the challenge lies. It's not reading a box score, it's not watching mm-hmm. a game.
Right.
It's the comparison of players. Mm-hmm. It's when we talk about a guy's contract mm-hmm. and what they're worth. Mm-hmm. That's where I think there's some challenges. And truthfully, that's where I think some people have run into some problems.
Yes. You're right. I don't think you're wrong at all. For me, it's never been a problem in that regard, though, because how you start off the relationships matter. If I come to you and I say, this is who we are, I have to write about what I see you do on the court or the field of play. That's my story to tell. Now, you could give me quotes. You could give me your perspective and I'll quote you. But whatever I believe I saw, you're going to be hard pressed to convince me that I saw something different. You got a shot and I'm going to listen. But what I saw is what the hell I saw. That's entirely different when it comes to off the court or field of play. Yeah. Now, that's your story. And so I've always made sure that players who know me understand that. If you don't know Stephen A. Smith as a professional athlete, that's your problem. Because I make myself available. There's no athlete on the planet that can say they can't find me. If I'm talking about you, I'm the easiest person to find. I'm not hiding because that's when it's really, really weak and incredibly unfair to that athlete. You have to make sure that athlete has access to you if they want it. If you don't want it, it's at your peril. I've had players come up to me, you bitch, fucking asshole, I hate your ass. Okay? Knock yourself out. You know what I'm saying? I'm not losing any sleep over it because all you had to do was talk to me. And no matter what I feel, I have an obligation as a professional and as a human, not only to hear your side, but to make sure I convey your perspective, even if I disagree. JJ Redick and I come on First Take. Yes, we've disagreed. Tell me one time where I've said, no, you can't express your point, but I can express mine. I've never done that. I always make sure everyone gets heard. That's my obligation, to make sure that you're heard and to make sure you get a fair shake. Not that I have to agree with you. Yeah. Not when it comes to your professional performance. Your personal life is different because we don't know what goes on in the walls of your home, your personal life, figuratively speaking, whatever. We don't know that. That's your story to tell. But field of court of play? Oh, no. That's mine.
Real quick, before we go on to the next thing, I do want to ask you just about AI and that period of time in Philadelphia because, that was when I was in high school and him along with Kobe, that sort of next era, that post-Jordan era, was an interesting time for the NBA, but specifically as it relates to Philadelphia. And having played there for 2 years and seen the receptions that he gets when he comes back, what do you think it was about Allen Iverson in probably the toughest sports town to be revered in that still to this day he is so revered?
Easily. He was a warrior. Philadelphia is a phenomenal sports town. I loved my time there. Philadelphia is a town, however, with a complex. It never feels like it's respected and appreciated to the degree that it deserves. Allen Iverson eradicated all of that. Allen Iverson represented Philadelphia, personified everything that Philadelphia saw itself as. Undersized, underdog, in a land of giants, but still conquering. That's how they viewed Allen Iverson. And Allen Iverson... practice, man. We talking about practice. The Allen Iverson that was in Fridays all the damn time on City Avenue. The Allen Iverson that was running the streets and stuff like that was not the Allen Iverson that showed up when it was time to perform. The brighter the lights, the bigger the challenge, the more he welcomed it. That's Philadelphia. And that's why somebody, dare I say, like Ben Simmons, not literally, but figuratively speaking, he can never go back. They will never forgive him, ever, because they view him as a coward. I don't view him as that. That's a bit extreme. I don't know all the intricacies of what's going on with him. I just feel like, hey, you still asking for your money, so I got a problem with that. But Philadelphia? Philadelphia believes he's a coward. Philadelphia believes he's the antithesis of everything Allen Iverson personified. And if anything, Ben Simmons' existence over the last year has elevated the allure to Allen Iverson even more, because they're saying, damn, we missed that. And remember, when they went to the finals, Aaron McKee, tough, hard-nosed player, George Lynch, Tyrone Hill, Dikembe Mutombo, these guys, they all had Eric Snow. They all had that kind of personality. Wasn't blessed with tremendous mercurial abilities, but they were hard-nosed. They ran from no damn body. And Allen Iverson was their star.
Yeah.
We talked about this with Gary Payton last week. I'm curious what you think about it. Mm-hmm. Having a little bit of sympathy for some of the guys now, not just in the NBA, but just, you know, pro athletes in general, with social media and with the constant barrage of criticism and attention all the time with everything. They make a mistake and it becomes a 24-hour talking point. But Gary was like, he's like, I don't think I would have been able to make it if I was playing, if I was doing everything I was doing off the court.
Yeah.
When, if I was like his son now, like, yeah, if I was playing now, I wouldn't be able to make it. Do you feel that, having sort of covered both the, like, AI, obviously, like, in a generation where that didn't exist, and now covering these guys today?
I don't feel sorry for them. I know that exists, but I don't feel sorry for them. And here's why I don't feel sorry for them. Because you're no different than the rest of us. I ain't playing the NBA. I blink wrong. Could you imagine what they're going to say about me on social media? It's most of us now. Everybody wants a voice. Everybody wants their voice to be heard. And by the way, it's not because they have this insatiable appetite to be heard. They think it could be monetized. And in some cases, it can. And so when you think about it, we all want to act like dollars and cents doesn't have something to do with everything. But damn it, if it ain't everything, it's most things. And when you think about social media, that's what you have to think about. You got people who are YouTube stars. You've got females who are Instagram stars. I mean, think about that for a second here. And so when you have that going on and you find a way to monetize, well, guess what? The vast majority of American citizens ain't making but so much money. And so not only that, they got to show up to work. They got to answer the bosses they don't want to answer to. They got to show up to a job they don't want to show up to. They got to travel to get to that job through a means of transportation they would prefer not to utilize. You got all of this going on, and all of a sudden, I can get on my computer straight out of bed and make myself some money if I can somehow, some way, manufacture whatever abilities I have into something that resonates to an audience. That's how they're thinking. They, for example, JJ Redick complains all the time about being misquoted. He is absolutely right. What did I say to him? I didn't say to him he wouldn't be misquoted. I said, get used to it. It happens all the time. You know how many times people will clickbait something and they put a headline and it had nothing to do with what I said?
It's aggregate but bullshit.
That's, yeah, right. They do it, right? Yeah. Because that way you click on it and you read the article. Here's where it's a problem for somebody like me. Half the time, people hold stuff against me based on the headline. They never even read the article. They never even saw the clip. They saw the headline, and they said, that damn Stephen A., here he go again. And they do stuff like that. I accept it. I understand that it comes with the territory. I understand the reason for its existence. And the modern-day player has to understand it, too, because they want to, if you want to utilize something to your advantage, you have to recognize its detriment. You have an obligation to do that.
This leads right into, I think, a really important topic that I wanted to ask you about, and sure, that's just this wave of athlete-driven content, athletes owning and having their own platforms. Sure. Of course, Draymond with this catchphrase, if you will, yeah, the new media, the new media. Yeah. And like, just to provide some sort of personal opinion on this, mm-hmm, I don't think athlete-driven content will ever replace traditional journalists or traditional reporters.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think about how you started.
Yeah.
You need a beat writer.
Yeah.
You need reporters.
That's right. You need experience.
You need hosts. So it's, to me, it's a welcome addition. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm you know, admittedly a little biased in that, sure, of course. It's a welcome addition, but I do want to get your perspective on it.
I love it. I love the fact that athletes have this outlet. I have a career spanning 28 years where I've been fighting for athletes my entire career. That's why I can call them out, because I'm quick to sit up there and say, okay, here's what I've done on this side for you. you pointing about something this matters this much when I'm supportive on stuff that matters this much. Well, I had to have the objectivity in order to pull that off. And I don't have it if I can never disagree with you. So let's understand that. And when you look at athletes today, there are so many athletes that are highly intelligent, incredibly accomplished, and more importantly, whose hearts are in the right place, particularly because of what they endured. And the fact that they have an opportunity to disseminate that message is something that pleases me. The fact that they see something that can be an outlet and an extension of their career, something beyond their playing careers that they can monetize to their benefit, is something we should all welcome. What do you want? You want the handful of athletes that's making eight and nine figure salaries and what have you. What do you want them to do? Be done at age 35? Wondering what the hell they're going to do with the rest of their life while the rest of us are out here working? Certainly, we may not make the money that a few of them have made in our lifetimes. But the point is, we have something to do and we have a direction and we have a focus, and it preoccupies our mind and our spirit in such a way that it inspires us to march forward and to move forward, as opposed to that lost athlete wondering what the hell are they going to do with the rest of their life. Why should any of us want that? So I'm incredibly supportive of athletes having that voice and expressing it. Just understand all that comes with it. Understand the good, the bad, and the potential ugly that comes along with it, and be willing to accept it all if you're going to venture into it. That's my only criteria. Outside of that, knock yourself out, which is why I've often said, look, you know, I remember one time LeBron had me speak in Akron at one of his camps, and, you know, Kobe had me come one time, and I was talking to guys, and they were like, you know, when are you available to do this? And I said, for y'all, always. And they were like, why? I said, we come to y'all asking y'all for y'all time every day. I know it's in your contract. You're supposed to talk to the media, whatever. But the bottom line is, I don't know of a single athlete who hasn't extended themselves to give time to others that they didn't have to give. The least we could do is do the same. And so I always pride myself in doing that. And I always pride myself on supporting athletes, having a voice. And I'll never deviate from that. Just know what you're talking about and know what the consequences are if you don't. And we could.
I think it's, yeah, I agree with all that. And I think the second chapter part of every athlete's life is very difficult when they retire. It's right. It is like a death,
yes.
Having just gone through it over the last year. And so the monetization, if it is in the media space, is obviously important. I do think, as it relates to the media space, having a different perspective, having a narrative and a discourse that comes from experience to go up against a journalist or a reporter, I think that's important. Again, it goes like, we're all shaped by our own experience. Our opinions oftentimes are shaped by our own experiences. And so I think that whether it is Draymond or CJ McCollum, who's been here the last couple of days, like, being able to get their perspective on things provides balance. And of course, we could go to any sport right now, and there's athletes all over the world who are owning and driving their own platforms.
You're not wrong. The only thing that I would say to you, JJ, is understand everybody ain't you. And what I mean by that is that you have the ability to go up against traditional, conventional journalists and give a perspective that's on their level, even though their perspective is totally different than yours.
And most and oftentimes wrong.
That's whatever you say, right? The bottom line is, the perspective that you provide, you have the ability to articulate it in a way that we articulate our thoughts. And that's okay. But when you have people that will come at you and just say, you don't know what the hell you're talking about. Well, why? Because you never played. That doesn't cut it. And you know what I've said? Because you've got a lot of guys that have podcasts. You've got a lot of guys that have ventured in a lot of things. And they've come to me asking me for advice, for crying out loud, in terms of this business. And I've often said to them, when you say stuff like that, you think you're insulting me. You don't realize you already lost the debate. You're insulting the audience because they didn't play either. So when you say that, you think you're talking to me. No, you're not. You're talking to 99% of the population out there who aren't fortunate to be the less than 1% that you are to play on this level. So when your cry is, I played, you didn't, you don't understand this, so let me explain, and blah, 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 blah. The audience is like, who the hell you think you are? Really? That's how you talking to us? We watch. We got 2 eyes. We saw what you did. Now, granted, they don't know what you know. But in the same breath, when you articulate it that way, I've already beaten you. Because the objective is to be heard, not just listened to. They're going to hear me because I'm speaking their language. They're ignoring you because you spoke against their language. And I know that. So I start laughing the moment somebody does that because you already lost. You already lost. And I'm mindful and cognizant of that. Part of communication is understanding who you're communicating with, who you're reaching, and keeping them there. And I know how to do that.
I have a debating question. I was thinking about this when we were talking about this earlier, and this is not even just with athletes. In general, going back to the beginning of your career, we talk with players a lot about when they are either offensively or defensively, when they see their opponent, if they can like see fear in their eyes, when they're sizing them up, if they can tell right away, oh, like I've got this person, I'm in their head. When you're debating somebody and you know you're debating them and they don't have it, can you tell right away? Do you have to like figure it out a little bit?
Yeah, but for me personally, that's where the human side comes. I might get on you. I'll get on you if you know what you're talking about. But I just disagree. If I know you're clueless, if I know that you just don't have the ability to, you know, volley back and forth against me verbally, I'll pick that up right away and I'll dial it back. Because then that's just a beat down, and I'm really not trying to do that. I'm trying to make my argument more profound than yours. I'm not trying to embarrass you. I'm not trying to hurt you. I'm not trying to let you allow you to be viewed as somebody who doesn't even belong sitting across the set from me when I'm the one that gave the okay for you to sit across the set from me to begin with. I'm not doing that to you. I'm going to protect the people that are on the show with me. I've got their back. We disagree on a subject. But what's not going to happen is that you're going to leave the show and everybody's going to be attacking you. And I'm going to leave you to stand there by yourself when I was the one who okayed you being on the damn show. As far as I'm concerned, the people on my show and the people that I work with and the people that are sparring against me verbally and stuff like that, they're my teammates. And so I'm going to treat them as such. I'm always going to do that.
All right. I've got to go on Max Kellerman. This just in like 7 minutes.
Sure.
So I do want to finish up with the fact that you for 7 months now have said the Warriors are going to win the championship. How are you feeling? We're recording this.
I'm a little nervous.
The day before game three.
I'm entitled to be nervous,
the day before game three.
I'm entitled to be nervous. I mean, listen, you got the Boston Celtics winning the championship. I don't blame you one bit. They're pretty damn good. They're an elite defensive team. We know what they bring to the equation offensively. And if we didn't know, all we got to do is listen to you and we'll know because you've told us numerous times. You're absolutely right. I'm just thinking the Warriors, with that experience, with their marksmanship, they should be able to win this series. But I will openly confess, I honestly don't know who I would have picked had I not been riding the Warriors all year long. The fact that I started off the season
picking the Warriors,
I'm not jumping off the ship. I'm not doing it. I'm staying right where I've been all year long. And if I got to go down, I got to go down.
Credit to you, and I gave you credit. You know, when they made the when they made the finals.
Yeah.
I mean, one of my first times on the show, I told you to slow the fuck down with the Warriors talk. They were, I think, 8-1.
They were
9 games into the season. And I was like, easy, boss, man.
I said, I'm telling you what I'm saying.
So credit to you, man. You called it.
That's
you called it.
Yes, I did, JJ. Thank you for very much admitting that. Yes, I did call it, okay? Because, and this is the crime with JJ. That'll make no sense. I love JJ
as a crime.
It was a crime. I'm getting ready to tell you what that crime is. I've loved JJ for years because the man could shoot, and there's very, very few people who could shoot off the move the way that you did. I thought that was a big, big deal because you took a lot of pressure off, you know, your backcourt mates throughout the years because of your ability to do that. That's just my opinion. And I'm saying, how the hell is he, of all people, not seeing what I'm seeing in these Warriors? How is he not getting this? Because if you're JJ Redick, you're supposed to see this clearer than me. But somehow, some way, you were caught in with the Phoenix Suns. Yes, you were.
Caught in with the Phoenix Suns.
You were
caught in.
And I said to you, listen, I'm telling you right now, what Dallas did to them, I thought Golden State was going to do to them in about 5 or 6 games.
That's fair.
That's what I thought was going to happen to them. That's I was fair. Like, they can't mess with, they can say whatever they want. They will beat Phoenix. That's
but
what
this,
I thought.
This is where I joke about the misquoting, because you're portraying me as a Warriors hater.
No, and, not a no, Warriors no, no. hater.
But listen,
go ahead.
Somebody the other day commented on something. They were like, oh, you've picked against the Warriors in every series. And I'm like, no, I didn't. I picked the Warriors over the Nuggets.
I love it. I love it when
they do
that. I picked
the Warriors over the Grizzlies.
I love it.
I picked the Warriors over the Mavs. I said it. I said at the beginning of the playoffs, I thought the Suns would win the West.
That's right.
I'd never picked the Warriors against the Warriors in any series until the finals.
I'm just saying you was on the Suns. You thought they would lose to the Suns, which means you thought the Suns was going to get to the finals instead of the Warriors. That's all I'm trying to say. But I love how JJ Gullick did. I got to make sure I'm correct because people are misquoting me, and I'm like this. Athlete, I said, we go through this stuff all the time. And listen, Draymond complained about this one time, KD, along with other players, I mean, CP3, others, and I went like this. Welcome to my world. How does it feel? I love the fact that y'all suffer like this. It makes me feel
some
good.
Of it, though, and we were talking about this with Grant yesterday. Right. Some of this, though, we, and I probably did this too, mm-hmm. we now have lumped essentially traditional media, we as players, we have lumped traditional media, aggregate media, which is the worst type of media, and social media. Like, aggregate media is worse than social media to me. Yeah. We've lumped all three of those things. So all the people with Attila87462 Twitter handles who make negative comments, that's media. Mm-hmm. Clutch Points, terrible website, that's media. Traditional media, that's all media. Right. So when we talk about being misquoted or misrepresented, we're taking out what may happen on this side of media, on social media, or on an aggregate media, on traditional media.
Exactly. And I hold the athletes accountable to that, because you have an opportunity to cultivate relationships. In life, everything's about relationships. Everything's about relationships. I've never known JJ the way that we know each other now. He knows he can call me now. I know I can call him now. You know, numerous players in the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, and others. It's like, wait a minute here. You know, I never thought I'd have the relationship with Alex Rodriguez that I have. You know, I never thought that I'd be in a restaurant in the Four Seasons and somebody say, "Could you, excuse me, sir, Derek Jeter's waiting to say hello to you." I never thought that would happen for me. You know what I'm saying? Or you know, Michael Jordan is on speed dial and Magic and all of these other guys. I never thought that that would happen. But at the end of the day, as an athlete, you are empowered to cultivate the relationships with anybody that's relatively decent. You can't come to me and tell, I don't give a damn what anybody says. I know how I was raised. I'm never going to lie to you about you on purpose. I'm never going to know something's wrong and say it publicly. I'm never going to put your personal business out in the street for no reason. You see, I'm never going to do things like that. I would never do something like that. I've had players that'll sit up there and say, "Sorry, motherfucker, I can't stand your ass." And a month later, "Man, I need your help." And I'm like, "What you need?" Because I understand that you're mad in the moment, whatever. Who cares? At the end of the day, I want us all to eat. I want us all to be successful. I've never rooted against an athlete in my life because I understand what they endure and what they go against. I'm sensitive to it, and I got love for them for it, and I'm always going to be here. But in the same breath, I'm going to tell the truth as I see it as it pertains to your performance. That's it. Anything else you could talk to me about, except for what you do in front of millions of people watching on television and 20,000 people in attendance. That, I'm going by what I saw.
Fair enough. Yes. Stephen A., we appreciate the time.
Man.
I just, so everybody knows, for the YouTube audience and obviously the listeners, we had to record this in two different segments. That's why there was a chair switch.
That's
Stephen
right.
A. wanted to sit above us.
No, I wanted
as
to be
the
more
king on his throne.
I wanted to be comfortable.
As the king on his throne. He talked for 20 minutes about power. This was all about power. This
was
a power
not.
Move by
That's
Stephen
his story.
A.
That's his narrative. We'll stick to it because it's his podcast. Appreciate you, baby.
Thank you.
If you like The Old Man and the Three, you can listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back.
We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Yo, Trey.
Kevin, what's up, man?
You know, I've been thinking, what would have happened if the NBA never vetoes the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers and we get CP3 in the same backcourt as Kobe in LA?
Well, you get a very happy Jack Nicholson, for sure.
And the Lakers probably win a bunch more championships. CP3 finally gets a ring or two or three. And the Kardashian empire is forever altered.
What did you just say? Hey, everybody, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier, and we're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass.
Or play call. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.